number three, and that is 093082, Lord Exodus versus the Wackenhut Corporation. Good morning. Mr. Memon?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. I stand here before you with two strikes against me. I'm sick, and I'm scared.
No. The scared, you... Look at these faces.
Scares me, too.
You've come to the friendly confines of the federal building today. The sickness we can't help you with.
Right. Well, it's always, I would say, intimidating to appear before the Seventh Circuit.
Not always.
Well, I hope you'll bear with me if I'm a little bit slow in responding to your questions and if you hear a quaver in my voice. Mr. Exodus is an African-American male who wears dreadlocks for religious reasons. He's worked as a security officer since March 2004 with his dreadlocks. In July 2004, Wackenhut denied him a job as a security officer because he would not cut off his dreadlocks.
Now, just to be clear at the outset, we're not talking about a failure to accommodate in this case. But rather a failure to hire that was based on a religious practice which was known to the employer.
That's correct, Your Honor.
See how easy it is?
Well, I do appreciate the softball to get me started, Judge. We had a bench trial before a judge from Louisiana, Judge Walter, who found that Wackenhut had no reason to think that religion might be an issue in this case. I'd like to highlight two major arguments on liability and three brief arguments on damages. The first argument regarding liability is that there are problems with Judge Walter's factual findings. The first problem is legal error. Judge Walter found that Exodus was not credible because his EEOC charge did not contain details of his conversation with the interviewer, McCullough. But that is not proper impeachment by omission, because you would not naturally expect all details of an incident to go into an EEOC charge drafted by a bureaucrat. What would be natural would be for a charging party to give all the details to the EEOC in a charge questionnaire and in an intake interview. Now, adding insult to injury on this point, Judge Walter disregarded Exodus's prior consistent statement to the EEOC, his EEOC charge questionnaire, in which Mr. Exodus did provide all the details that Judge Walter found missing from the EEOC charge.
Wasn't it just one detail, which was whether he said explicitly that he wore his hair that way because of his religious beliefs?
Right.
So that's all we need to worry about.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Yes, Your Honor. Now, Judge Walter disregarded that prior consistent statement to the EEOC on the basis of Novitski versus American Consulting Engineers, which had nothing to do with prior consistent statements. And Novitski certainly did not hold that EEOC questionnaires are never relevant for any purpose. In addition, in Vela versus Village of Sauk, I believe that this court has stepped back from its holding in Novitski regarding the use of EEOC charge questionnaires, even in cases relating to the scope of a charge. The second major problem that we have with Judge Walter's factual findings, Judge Walter credited all of Mr. McCullough's testimony, the interviewer's testimony, regarding what happened in the job interview.
See, now that's your greatest hurdle, because Judge Walter made a straightforward credibility determination. You know, you've made a very good case for why he should have credited Mr. Exodus over Mr. McCuller. But on what basis can we say that this is one of those extremely rare cases in which his credibility finding was, you know, clearly erroneous? That's what we've got to do here.
Well, Your Honor, it seems to me that my job is not that hard, because the test laid out in Anderson versus the City of Bessemer City is that you can find the credibility finding was clearly erroneous if the testimony is contradicted by documents or other objective evidence. And here, the documents that contradict Mr. McCuller's testimony are better than objective, because these are Wackenhut's own documents.
Look, you have prior inconsistent statements in all kinds of cases. And we all know they can be used to impeach credibility, but there are also sometimes perfectly legitimate reasons for that, and that's why we have triers of fact. Can you direct us to some cases that have said, in this kind of a he said versus he said context, two people in the room, they testify differently about it, that have held clearly erroneous a decision to credit one version over the other?
Well, Your Honor, I can point you to the case that Judge Bucklow cited in her summary judgment opinion, EEOC versus Ilona of Hungary, where this court overturned the district court's credibility finding based on less than this. There, and I can quote the language to you, there this court overturned a credibility finding simply on the basis of contrary testimony. There were no documents challenging that finding, and the language is, despite the court's doubts about Glukowski's credibility, meaning the district court's doubts, it nevertheless concluded as a matter of fact that Glukowski would have continued to work at Ilona had she not been fired. But this finding ignores the testimony of several of Glukowski's co-workers that Glukowski had no intention of continuing to work at the salon. Then they list the co-workers who testified differently, and this court said, in light of the evidence presented, we conclude that the district court clearly erred in finding as a matter of fact that Glukowski would have continued to work at the salon had she not been terminated. There was also a case...
Wasn't that case affirmed, Ilona of Hungary?
Yes, Your Honor, but that factual finding, that credibility finding,
yeah,
was...
I was the district court, that's I.
I do believe the district court opinion was better than the Seventh Circuit opinion in that case, Judge. There was also a case, Kidd versus Illinois State Police, where this court could not reconcile conflicts between DeBerry's testimony, which was credited by the district court, but contradicted by documents produced by DeBerry's employer. And, Your Honor, if you need the cite, would that be helpful for you, sir? No. 167 F3rd 1084.
Was that in your briefs?
No, Your Honor. I came across that in preparing for oral argument. So,
you, of course, notified your opponent of the fact that you discovered it.
It's in the mail, Your Honor. No, it's not. No, I did not notify them. Was I required to?
You're supposed to.
To notify a party of any new cases that I come across?
You're citing a case that's not in your brief, not in the record. You're supposed to tell him.
I see.
But it was in response to the judge's question, so you may not have known that that was coming.
Right.
But it's, you know, it's sort of insurance.
The other issue here, Your Honor, you mentioned prior consistent statements. We have more than that here. Here we have a memo from Mr. McCullough's boss. This is not a statement prepared directly by the interviewer, although that his email is certainly very, I think, very helpful to us. But Mr. Kroll's memo also contradicts Mr. McCullough's testimony. The next problem that we and to finish up on this issue, these documents, recall, we're talking in this case about one incident, one job interview. And once a witness, McCullough, starts changing his story about parts of that one incident, that should raise some red flags. The third problem that we have with Mr. McCullough's, Judge Walter's findings, factual findings, is that Mr. McCullough's testimony was implausible on its face. And here I'm referring to our argument that a security company that prides itself on discipline and professionalism would not say to an applicant who walked out the door, allegedly in the middle of an interview, that he could come back if he cut his hair.
May I suggest you're in your rebuttal time, but do whatever you want to.
Thank you, Your Honor. I was concerned this would happen because of my... The fourth problem that we have with the factual findings is that they are based on what appears to be Judge Walter's personal speculative viewpoint. How else can one describe Judge Walter's conclusion that Exodus's scenario was inconsistent with human nature? And finally, the final problem with the factual finding is that they are simply not explained. There's no roadmap to allow you to determine whether the findings were properly arrived at. Judge Walter did not explain the findings he made. He did not explain the issues, why he chose not to address issues like Mr. McCullough's motivation to lie during the EEOC investigation process due to his disciplinary problems, or his motivation to lie at trial because of the decent chance that he may end up going back to work for Wackenhut when the building contract changes hands again. If you agree with us that there are problems with the factual findings, then we would request a new trial before a new judge on liability and damages. The second major problem that we have regarding liability, even accepting the facts as Judge Walter found them, along with undisputed facts, Mr. McCullough had enough information and opportunity to require him to continue with the interactive process. Judge Walter found that Mr. Exodus said he could not cut off his dreadlocks because of his belief. Mr. McCullough testified that he knew a belief could be religious. Mr. McCullough also said that he thought Lord Exodus was an unusual name. Both those words are featured prominently in the Bible. Mr. McCullough knew, he testified that he knew that the word Lord had religious significance. Mr. McCullough spoke to Mr. Exodus after Mr. Exodus said he could not cut off his dreadlocks because of his belief.
That was, according to Judge Walter's findings, as he was walking out the
door,
correct?
Yes, okay. Your Honor. Yes,
there
Your
was
Honor.
A duty, as you see it, to chase after him?
Your Honor, I don't think there would have been any chasing involved because Mr. Exodus didn't leave Wackenhut. Mr. Exodus walked from the interview room to the lobby and sat down. Mr. McCullough walked from the interview room to the lobby and summoned the next applicant. Mr. Exodus sat there and waited, watching applicants get called in and come out. That goes to the issue of opportunity, of Mr. McCullough's opportunity to talk to Mr. Exodus if he had wanted to. But there's one other point on this issue.
I think I have to stop you.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
And but I will give you a minute or two for rebuttal, even though you've used it up.
Thank you, Your Honor. And may I just say that since, although I haven't had an opportunity to address damages, we are not waiving any of our arguments. Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Mr. Lapp.
Good morning, Your Honors. Rich Lapp on behalf of Defendant Wackenhut. Let me first address some of the information that was just relayed by counsel before I address, if necessary, the roadmap that Judge Walter did, I think, lay out in conclusion of this case, fully compliant with Rule 52. A couple of notable things. One, I think after Judge Rodner's question, we all agree that the issue in this case is the failure to hire based on a religious practice that was known to the employer. We didn't hear anything in counsel's argument that would lead a reasonable person to believe or to certainly overturn a finding by Judge Walter that the religious practice was known to the employer. Counsel represented that certain testimony with respect to Mr. McCullough, that he understood belief could encompass religious belief. But at Supplemental Appendix, page 93, lines 2 through 10, Mr. McCullough makes clear in response to questions from opposing counsel that he can't speculate what is meant by relief, and relief could mean anything. And I think that that's a difficult concept to argue with, that the fact that belief could mean anything.
Now, one of the grounds that Judge Walter cited for his decision to credit Mr. McCullough over Mr. Exodus was that the charge against Wackenhut was the sole charge that did not allege that Mr. Exodus discussed the religious basis for wearing his dreadlocks. But was it logical to rely on the charge in assessing Mr. Exodus's credibility as a witness, given that he apparently did make this allegation in his EEOC questionnaire, and it was the EEOC interviewer who omitted it from the charge, not Mr. Exodus?
I think it was both fair and logical within the context of this trial. What Judge Walter also pointed out was those same bureaucrats prepared the other four charges that all had the extra detail in them. And it's significant that a trier of fact would seize on a piece of evidence that is material, it is a sworn statement, that happens to leave out a detail that is critical to the plaintiff's case. Whether another trier of fact could reach a different conclusion, that may be, but I don't think it's illogical, and I don't think it's unfair for Judge Walter to have seized on that difference, particularly when that coincided with Mr. McCullough's testimony. And I think that's the link here.
It's Mr. Lapp, yes. I mean, one of the concerns I have about this is the reliance on Nikolsky, which obviously doesn't have anything to do with whether this is admissible for the purpose of providing a prior consistent statement under these circumstances. Did Judge Walters show that he was actually considering the circumstances and evaluate the weight that should be given the questionnaire? Or did he just say, Nikolsky, objection sustained, you're out of, stop talking about this?
I believe that, I would say that Judge Walter, the context of that comment is Judge Walter, is he's assessing Mr. McCullough's testimony and what the sparseness of that interview, and is now shown the EEOC charges and sees that those EEOC charges, as written, reflect exactly what Mr. McCullough has been testifying to. I can't speak to whether Judge Walter took into context that there was additional information contained within the intake questionnaire, or whether the
if there's a page in the record you want to refer us to, that would be fine.
There may be. I think the point that Your Honor was making with respect to the charges is that his overall point was it coincided with Mr. McCullough's testimony that this item was left out, and also that the bureaucrats that counsel was complaining had created the same these charges also created had created the whack-a-nut charge, had created and prepared the other charges. And I think it's also important to notice that the charges are not the only basis on which Judge Walter decided to credit Mr. McCullough or discredit Mr. Exodus.
Oh, well, you know, I understand that as a general rule, it's the charge that governs, and that Mr. Exodus is responsible for its contents. But I am questioning using the charge as a basis to discount Mr. Exodus's credibility, given what he had said in his questionnaire.
I guess what I'm saying with respect to those charges is that those charges are part of an overall assessment of the credibility of both of these gentlemen in the very short conversation that took place.
But let me put it this way. You know this record better than I do. Can you direct me to where Judge Walters was excluding that, the consideration of that questionnaire?
At the supplemental appendix, pages 282 through 284, is the discussion with the court.
Okay, thank you.
And what does he say, basically?
There's just a discussion here of the question is he's speaking about the impact of the charge, putting the employer on notice. He's speaking about the charge in terms of who prepared it, who's responsible for the contents of that charge. There's a discussion about whether there was counsel present, and that's really the sum and substance of that discussion.
Was the questionnaire offered as a prior consistent statement?
I can't speak to that, Your Honor.
All right. Mm-hmm.
But I would just hasten to put the charge discussion in its proper place with respect to this assessment of credibility, so that as the two witnesses are being examined by Judge Walter, the attacks on Mr. McCullough's credibility are that he has given inconsistent statements when, in fact, he hasn't. Every time Mr. McCullough has recited the version of events, the one core fact that's consistent is that Mr. Exodus had only said that cutting his hair would be inconsistent with his belief or beliefs. That's it. And that one core fact stays the same throughout, and that one core fact sets the stage for the rest of the legal analysis. And that is whether that simple statement was sufficient enough to put Wackenhut on notice that there was a religious practice at issue here, particularly in the context when Mr. Exodus is walking out of this short interview as he's uttering that statement. With respect to the Rule 52 challenge that we've heard, and while it's been covered primarily in what I've discussed already, I think Judge Walter's order and subsequent colloquy with counsel provide this court with the roadmap to his decision. He disclosed the steps necessary to reach the ultimate finding of fact, and that is what was said in this interview between these two individuals. And to Your Honor's point, while I haven't seen the case that counsel cited, from his recitation, there is no other case that counsel cited, I believe, that in a one-on-one conversation, the Court of Appeals overturned the district court's finding of fact on a he-said situation, at least with respect to the case that I heard described. I have not read that case, but that's not what I heard. With respect to the Rule 52 issue, though, I think that the judge not only disclosed his steps to his factual findings, he discussed the subsidiary issues along the way. He discussed and considered the Kroll Memorandum. He discussed and considered Patty Marmon's testimony. He discussed and considered the interaction between the two and the stark differences between the two interview scenarios, and gave a full accounting, I think, of his rationale. And lastly, I would say that under the cases of both Reed and Redman of this court, there was not enough information from which you could fairly charge Wackenhut that it knew that there was a religious practice at stake. It was only fairly charged with knowing that this individual had identified some belief, unknown, unstated, that prevented him from cutting his hair, and on that basis proceeded to act lawfully in not, either not pursuing him or not offering this man a job.
Thank you very much. Now, I'm going to give you 2 minutes. So,
Your Honors, to answer some of the points that counsel made, Judge Walter explicitly stated in his opinion that his credibility finding related to the EEOC charge issue was based on Novitzky. He also made that very clear in on the record.
Do we find in the record that you offered it as a prior consistent statement?
Yes. Mr. Exodus testified.
Where do we find it?
Your Honor, I'm sorry. I left my may I pick up my materials? Thank you. Mr. Exodus testified that he had informed the EEOC about the details. The transcript, page 276, lines 12 to 16.
I'm looking for some place where you brought to the court's attention, in essence, this is not a Novitzky-like problem. We're offering this only as a prior consistent statement.
Yes, sir. Okay. That did happen. And I informed Judge Walter that Novitzky was a case dealing with the scope of a charge. On page 277, when I tried to get into what had happened at the EEOC, Wackenhut objected on the basis of Novitzky. And then on page 278, I explained to Judge Walter towards the bottom of the page, right, Judge, but the issue in the case was if an employee says I was discriminated against on the basis of my age and my gender, and then files a lawsuit saying I was discriminated against on the basis of my disability, what I was trying to say is scope of the Novitzky deals with the scope of a charge. You have to bring the same issues in your charge, in your lawsuit, as you brought in your charge.
Well, we will take a look at that, and we're going to have to thank you because...
Your Honor, I just wanted to ask you if I could address the other questions that he raised.
We can't give you any more time. Well, it wouldn't be fair.
Thank you for making this as easy as you did. Thank you.
And get well. And we will take the case under advisement.